Talk Us Up, Sound Us, Elvis Costello, and The Attractions, right here on RTHK Radio 3. As we go into Tuesday lunchtime, it's a great pleasure to welcome back to the programme business futurist Morris Misalowski on the line from Melbourne. G'day, Morris. How's it
G'day,
going?
G'day, Phil.
I wondered if, firstly, something I was reading about a couple of weeks ago floating around was a wind-up, and secondly, I wondered if you've heard of it and how important it is. So apparently Apple has about 65 error messages it can throw at you at any time. One of them is error 53 that isn't on this list, and the word is, if your iPhone thinks that a non-Apple technician has been fiddling with your phone, it will commit suicide. Have you heard of this one?
Yeah, I have. It's an interesting one. Now, errors weren't invented by Apple. Every system has them. Microsoft, Linux, everybody has them. But this is a really interesting one because apparently, even though we kind of know what's causing it, Apple doesn't have a fix for it.
It's, so it's not an on-purpose, it's a bug,
well,
or we're not sure.
As far as we understand, and because nobody really can understand what caused it, we don't know. But no, I think it's just more benign than that. What it appears to be is that on the iPhone 6, and it's only an iPhone 6 issue, is on the button on the front where you have to put your thumb on it to be able to open it up.
Yep.
What they've done is put technology in there, which seems to make sense, and that is that if it's not your thumb trying to open it up, then it shouldn't give access to anybody for anything. And that's quite useful and used in banks and other places. What's happened here is that some of the people have had a home button, which is where it is repaired, and the repair that they've put in hasn't matched in sequence to the internal phone. So it said, look, you're not it, and we're not going to let you in. That was one part of the error 53, but it got worse because there's a whole slew of people that claim they've never repaired, never had it broken, but for whatever reason, error 53 has just locked the phone down.
What about if you're on tour somewhere or in some far-flung town where there doesn't happen to be a genius bar, but there's a bloke here who knows how to fix your phone and you need it fixed?
Then you have a really expensive drink coaster for a while.
You do indeed.
I mean, there's nothing else to be said because Apple apparently itself says that at the store level, there's nothing they can do but replace the phone. So there ain't nobody around that apparently knows how to fix this so it'll work.
I'll tell you what, though. I mean, it may be a bug, but is this a small, small example of a computer thinking for itself? I mean, completely without us telling it to.
Well, thinking for itself or not thinking at all, one or the other, because some people would argue it's not thinking because it's obviously me and my phone and nothing's gone wrong. So I don't know which way to answer that, Phil, but yeah, it's an issue. And what it is a computer being obstinate, that it's programmed, it only has one thought, it only has one channel, one place it can go, and that's what it's doing.
I wonder if in days gone by Microsoft have done things like this, where they shoot themselves in the foot just to keep their brand and not let the competitors anywhere near it.
Yeah, every system's had errors. They absolutely have. I can't cite you an example, but I know there's been tons of them. Microsoft, because I've been at the end of them. Microsoft has always had issues, and it's always been buggy, and there's been simple things that you want to do that it won't let you do. It's just one of those things that just has gone wrong, and unfortunately for an Error 53 recipient, the only thing that appears to work is to take it into store and get them to give you a new one.
Which they seem to do quite willingly if you're really in shtuck, but I mean it's quite scary. And certainly the way it's been reported, they'd have you believe that Microsoft are doing it on that Apple are doing it on purpose.
Yeah, look, there's always going to be these conspiracy theories. I can't tell you that's what's happening. It seems to be more benign than that, and we want to give Apple,
yeah,
you know, the thought that it's not something they created for that sake. But it brings us back to a really simple point, and that is that we've got to be careful that we're backing up really well all our systems, because
yeah,
we never know, even with beautiful new software and hardware, when something might go wrong. And of course, we've all experienced it goes wrong at the worst time possible. So make sure we back up, make sure we have copies, and even, you know, God forbid, let's go back into the old analog world and maybe we even have some downloads and hard copies of stuff if we need them.
Well, that brings up a really interesting point, because very often people ask, how much can I trust any kind of cloud? I mean, just for my normal stuff, nothing secret, nothing contentious, just, you know, my pictures and my docs and this, that and the other. How much can I trust cloud? Lots of people asking that.
I think I believe that you can trust cloud a lot. The reality is that whatever you're sending up isn't going to one person. It's not going to somebody's home where they're sitting and rifling through it. It's going to a series of servers that are literally spread across the world. There are bits and pieces of stuff that you're sending that end up in Hong Kong and end up in Australia and end up in all sorts of places. When you ask, it assembles it back and brings it to you. So it's fairly safe. What is always unsafe is the connection between you and it, and of course that can be hacked by anybody. And of course, if you lose access to that cloud, it's not physically anywhere where you can go and get the bits and pieces from. Again, that's why I think you need multiple backups for most things you send into the cloud. Our emails and stuff, if we're using Hotmail or Google or something, are normally fairly safe. If we're sending up our own photos and things to be stored in cloud, I always have another copy of it somewhere else, always have.
Do you reckon part of the problem here is that visualization of what cloud might be? Because we always somehow think that there's going to be a human with sneaky hands attached, which, as you've just said, isn't the case.
It isn't the case. It just simply isn't the case. It's just huge mega servers. Some of them are literally buried under the ground. I mean, they are in remote places. It's really like something from a spy novel. They're buildings which have no address, underground. They're concrete roofs, you know, that whole thing. And that's mostly used by NASA and governments. That's all that cloud is, but it's based on algorithms. It's based on sending information across the planet and discreetly putting them away into various spaces so that people can't get their hands on them. As you and I have said many times, of course there are people with evil intentions. Nothing's going to stop them.
But think of these buildings then, Morris. Are they massive?
Oh, they're incredible. They literally are like something from sci-fi, you know, where it turns on and there's one bank of lights and another bank of lights and it goes on and on and on and it never seems to end. Some of them are literally that large. They just go on forever. They're air-conditioned. They're all the things that we see in our movies. That's some of them. Some of them are just smaller spaces. They're in buildings all over the place. But they're spread. But again, same message as before, I think that they are trustworthy. Our banking, our finance industries use them and have checked them out. All the big corporations who have far more money and time than you and I do have checked them out. But we've got to have our own security level. As I said, I always back up. I think it's a really good thing to do.
Yeah. I found out this morning, I bet there's some in Australia, because I found out this morning your population went up to 24 million, apparently.
It
that's
did.
Official.
It did at 2 o'clock this morning.
In such a massive place.
At?
The Australian population, the figure that came out overnight saying it's 24 million now, and obviously Aussie is such a massive place that I wonder how many of these things are buried under your country.
Well, they may be. We don't know about many of them. They certainly talk about them being overseas more than they do here. We certainly have server banks, and most of those are corporate owned, so we've got some idea of where they are in our buildings. But yeah, they could be. We've got lots of free space out in the middle of nowhere.
Yeah, you certainly do. Morris, I want you to do a bit of a history lesson for us, if you would. So today, in 1978, the world's first ever bulletin board was created, and I guess that was the sort of prehistoric internet.
Yeah, what would we ever use a bulletin board for, they were thinking in 1978. The reality was that they were a whole lot of geeks, mostly around universities, colleges, who wanted to find a really interesting way to be able to share files backwards and forwards. And they went into a bulletin board, which really is no more than an electronic post office. In other words, there was a centralized place where you could go, you had your postbox, so to speak, you could leave stuff in there, and you could rifle through other people's postboxes with their permission to find literature and notes and whatever else they wanted to put there for people to find. And you went backwards and forwards, remembering that this was in the time when we did all of it by telephone coupling. I don't know, you must remember back to the days, possibly, where we used to dial up and it used to have that wonderful sound attached to it and it would drop out 60 times or 100 times in the middle of a file upload or download. That was really the next generation of this.
Yeah, you got it. So we're talking 1978. How long before it in any way came into sort of the kind of use we know for today? I mean, perhaps 12, 13 years. I remember guys on bulletin boards in the early 90s.
Yeah, look, on a sad case, I was on them in the mid-80s. I bought a modem. But, you know, it was so rare and so unusual in those days that it was really just more of a folly. There was nothing you could do that was sensible with them. The fact that they existed was enough to tickle some people. Except, of course, the universities. That was really the great place for it. NASA used them a lot. You know, our high-end governments used them a lot. But for mainstream people, it really took until the early 90s before some people got on board. And it was the mid to late 90s. It is very much the precursor of the WWW, the World Wide Web, which was the next innovation on top of that. Because Byrne said it didn't make sense for these bulletin boards. It just wasn't a way that we could share information really well. There has to be an easier, better way to do it. And the World Wide Web that you and I know is really the incarnation, the innovation off the back of it.
is it the same as Windows was to all the information that was floating around? It just gave it a shop front that we could use.
Yeah, I think that's a really good analogy. It took DOS to Windows. Of course, it did much more. We kind of are assuming here that we're past the dial-up phase that dropped off, which was a big boon in this. Once we got past the dial-up phase and we got to cable modems and a few other things, and we began, of course, in about 10 years ago to use it on mobile devices, the whole nature of it changed.
I'm glad you brought up modems and cables and stuff. Everybody's into wireless these days. How much further can wireless go? Perhaps not just in terms of speed. Is it developed as far as it can be?
Oh, God, no, nowhere near it. When we look back in 10, 15, 20 years, we will be as shocked as what we're doing today as we were with what I just said about dial-up modems that dropped out all the time.
56K and stuff.
I mean, it's just phenomenal. We are improving all of the time. I'm getting literature every day and hearing about new innovations in this space. We're talking about sending things through water. We're talking about sending things at the speed of light, using lasers. There's all kinds of things that are being spoken about that may be part of this future. But the one thing we know for sure is it will get faster and swifter and become much more robust than it is.
Well, that's interesting. Put your business futurist head on here, Maurice, because now, here we are, 2016, talking about the 56K and all that sort of thing and all that kit as a thing of the past. How long before we're doing it about the kit we use now, do you reckon?
I think give it a couple of years. I mean, we're always talking about how slow it was last year and the year before and the year before. We really are changing the way that we do it. There was an interesting innovation last year called LiFi, which is LIFI, which is using the electricity signals in a home and the light signals to be able to send all of this information. That already in prototype is 100 times faster than anything we currently have, and that's, they think, only a year away from being commercialized.
I want to ask you about something that's on your website. The title of it is Microsoft may be running the biggest Turing test in history. What do you know?
Well, what we're talking about there is Microsoft looking at Turing test was, of course, the way to discover whether a robot was real or not. There's always been this really interesting dilemma of how we know when robots are smarter than human beings. And the Turing test is one of the ways that we came up with about 30 or 40 years ago to be able to understand possibly whether we'd reached that tipping point. So Microsoft is doing a whole lot of work, as is everyone else, around robotics, and they're fairly sure that they have the innovation in software and eventually hardware that would allow computers to fool most people. We already, unbeknownst to us, are phoning into call centres, and they're mostly airline ones where we think we're talking to a human being, but in fact we're not. We're talking to a very sophisticated bot. And we're going to see more and more of those as artificial intelligence rises over the next decade or so.
What's the significance of these things as opposed to, you know, replacing the human voice? It's all great in the movies and chatting about it now, but when it comes down to day-to-day stuff, is there a real space for this?
There absolutely is, but unfortunately part of that real space is doing away with some of the human jobs that currently do it. As always, when evolution evolves, some people that used to do it no longer have the need to do it. What we're going to see in this space is really artificial intelligence, which is the ability for a computer to think beyond its limitations of programming and be able to come up with a various solutions or as solution. We're going to see that come into a human form, which is that you and I will be able to talk to a computer. We've talked about personal robots, which are rising this year, which are machines we can buy for under $2,000 that can have conversations with us, Siri on steroid type stuff. And that's really where all of this is headed, Siri on steroids, things that we can talk to, things that understand us, know the world that we as individuals live in, and give us information relevant to that.
I wonder what will happen to us when all of the things to do with consumerism and deals and bartering or whatever it might be is handled by us talking to a machine. Well, what are we supposed to do with the energy we're left over with our real voices?
I think we're going to use them for great human purpose. It's a really interesting, it's a great question, one that we debate all the time. You know, what will humans do when robots or machines do it all?
When they do all the day-to-day stuff, yeah. The bean counting, the buying of the milk and the coffee, or whatever you want to call it, there's a great big chasm left.
Well, there is, but we've had
creativity.
But we've had that throughout history, Phil. I mean, what we've done always is to invent technology that's done exactly that. We innovated farming and took away a lot of the man activities in farming, sent it to machines. We've done it with food. Our fridges store food now. We no longer have to have people. There are lots of innovations along the way that have done exactly that, and we seem to find other purpose for it. My concern around it is that not that we won't find things for people to do, but as you said before, Australia's population tipped over the 24 million. We're going up to about 36 million by 2050. The planet's putting on 2.5 billion people in that same period in the next 30 or 40 years. It's not that we won't have enough work for the people that are around. It's my concern that we won't have enough work for the people that are coming.
Maurice, we're out of time. As always, fascinating talking to you. Maurice Misolowski, check him out online. Business Futurist, M-O-R-R-I-S, not the sophisticated French one. Take care, mate. We'll talk next week.
Look forward to it.